This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears and I'm joined as always by Bradley Chambers. Tonight we have three sponsors for the show, our good friends at Jam Software, makers of the Casper Suite tool that powers widespread use of Apple technologies in the enterprise, Aerohive, makers of cloud-managed controllerless Wi-Fi, and Tap Typing, an app that teaches students to type on the iPad. We'll tell you more about all of those as the show goes on. Bradley, how's life with the 6?
It is fantastic. I did my first trip with it this weekend. Uh-huh. We went down to Athens, Georgia to the Georgia-Tennessee football mm-hmm. game, which is, you know, in the South. That's a pretty big game. And so, you know, about a 3.5-hour drive down there. And so I got, you know, I had my phone on the charger. So when I got down there, it was about 100%. And by the time I got back in the car, many, many hours later, I was down to like maybe 60%. Wasn't really using my phone just a ton, but we would check in with scores mm-hmm. and things like that. So it's, you know, battery life seemed to be really as good as the 5 was when it was mm-hmm. new. So nothing, you know, but it's nice to have a new battery. One of the things, this isn't really iPhone specific, but it's interesting to see how much better the cellular service was in the stadium this year. Typically in years past, it's been heavy on the 4G service. Yeah. And so it was great to actually have LTE in Athens, Georgia this time around.
Interesting. And that's just as the network rolls out further, is that right?
Yes, okay. Yes, it was. People joke and say, why do you need your internet inside the stadium? And it's not that you do or don't, but it's just like we're checking in with other scores to see, because there's obviously teams that if they lose, that helps Georgia mm-hmm. out kind of thing. So we're trying to follow, you know, the other teams and whatnot. It's a whole big experience. Camera was fantastic as well. So yeah. How was life with the 6 Plus?
Life with the 6 Plus is not too bad. I still haven't bent it. Turns out that whole story was a load of rubbish, basically. I still find it to be quite large. I don't think I've quite adjusted my mental model of how big this thing actually is yet. And I'm desperately waiting for some updated apps to really take advantage of that screen. I mean, you messaged me before we came on air just about the latest episode of Accidental Tech Podcast, where they talked about the same topic. And I think the point that Marco made, and I would agree with it, is that developers really need to have access to and probably force themselves to use, even if they don't want to, use an iPhone 6 Plus just to get a feel for what it's really about. So I'm twiddling my thumbs, checking the App Store every day for new updates, and hoping that some come along quite soon.
Yeah, that's really the key. I mean, just as we mentioned, that if iPad apps were simply big iPhone apps, then we wouldn't probably be as high on the iPad as we yeah. were. But it's when you take that device size and squeeze everything you can out of yeah. it is the key.
Yeah.
And you know, I think it largely comes down to this is where the App Store economics come down to. You know, is there enough money for developers? Mm. Can they sell an app for a premium? You know, I know they can't really target specific devices, you know, like the 6 Plus, yeah. but I mean, maybe that's something they could do for, you know, maybe some sort of in-app purchase upgrade for a different interface. I don't know.
Apple will never allow anybody to do an in-app purchase for works with the iPhone 6 Plus.
Works better. iPhone 6 optimized.
Actually works on certain devices. No, thank you.
So it all comes down to economics. Mm-hmm. You know, is there enough money in it? And that comes down to how many phones Apple has sold, and we don't have any idea how at the makeup at this point. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, I guess it comes down to, is that a differentiator for an app that it's got a really, really optimized view for the bigger size?
Well, here's one thing that you might think about. I mean, it's often said that Apple doesn't have the majority of the market, but it has the best part of the market. And I suspect that may also be true of iPhone 6 Plus, that because it's the largest device and the most expensive device in the line, that the people who buy that may be more willing to spend money on good apps. And I know that, you know, if I had the choice between a paid app that really did a good job in the 6 Plus versus a free app that didn't, I would go for the more expensive app that actually worked well on the phone. I know that's not the majority of the App Store market, certainly. I mean, there's many, many App Store users, I'm sure, who have spent nothing on apps. And the fundamental problem, I think, is that there's a lot of people like that, or close to nothing. You know, people who spend as good as nothing, and maybe they spend on Candy Crush or something. But then the other problem is that Apple are moving so fast now and changing so many things that developers are struggling to keep up with Apple. And I'm sure that many developers are looking at this and saying, well, what's the cost benefit of me rushing to do Apple's latest thing every time Apple says jump and I just go how high? Maybe it'll come to the point where people have to take a break. I mean, we already saw this with iOS 7, that some developers didn't deliver an update for iOS 7 until iOS 8 was out. So it's a tricky time, I think, and I think Apple has to be careful not to push developers so far that they can't ever spend any time actually just like making their app better. You know, they've got to slow down at some point and give developers a chance to flesh out these apps, because otherwise what we're going to get is we're going to get iOS 5 functionality, and just all the time since then has just been spent keeping up with Apple's latest APIs. And I think that's an interesting challenge going forward. Should Apple take a year off iOS?
Yeah, I'm just ready. I just keep hitting the App Store, hoping for updates, because the apps, you know, like especially reading apps, Pocket, mm-hmm. Reader, those type apps look terrible.
The Kindle app as well is atrocious.
And just ready for an upgrade. And of course, that goes back to arguing about upgrade pricing. Mm-hmm. Would that motivate developers if they could charge for, you know, some sort of upgrade?
Yeah.
I don't know. But before we move on, let's take our first mm-hmm. sponsor of the night. It's the fine folks at Jamp Software. Jamp makes the great Casper suite that powers widespread use of Apple technology, such as Macs, iPads, iPhones, and Apple TVs, and all sorts of organizations, schools, businesses. And they have a great app for teachers called Casper Focus that goes directly on teachers' iPads, allows them to control their classroom experience. They can distribute iBooks, they can initiate AirPlay, they can select specific Apple TVs, they can conduct secure exams within an app. If you are an Apple school, you need the Casper suite. So if you want to learn more about Jamp software, go to attaschool.net, and this is show 105, and use a special URL for Jamp that lets them know that you came to them from our show. So thanks to Jamp for sponsoring the show this week. You know, one of the things that I've kind of been thinking about, there was had a discussion with some of my friends from This Week Setup on Slack over the weekend about Instapaper versus Pocket. Mm. And I'm actually a Pocket user, and I believe you are too.
Yep.
Is that correct? And I've gone back and forth over the years. Both apps are fantastic. And I was actually thinking of switching back to Instapaper. Mm-hmm. I had been, you know, some of their new app is fantastic. They've done a nice job. And I feel like the reading experience inside of Instapaper is better than Pocket's. But I like everything else about Pocket better, other than their own built-in share sheet, yeah. Which I hate. But the app updates faster. I just like the app better. But then I realized, well, Pocket has a Mac app, and Instapaper does not. Yeah. And previously, like, I didn't even care because of, you know, Instapaper's website was fast, Pocket's website was mm-hmm. fast. Didn't matter. But with continuity, that is so, so much more important now.
Yeah. I mean, I think I said that when we talked about, we did the sort of post-WWDC episode, when I said that continuity is going to privilege those companies who have an app on every platform, a native app on each of the platforms. So phone, tablet, and Mac. And I think that's the first example you're coming up with there, Bradley, is that being able to do continuity doesn't extend to the web yet. So that's something that's quite an interesting sort of side effect of continuity, is that it makes sense to have a native app on all possible platforms.
Yeah, even if your product doesn't normally even require an app, but just if that feature makes a difference. Mm-hmm. So yeah, something to think about as we kind of march towards the Yosemite release date, which I'm assuming is in a few weeks.
There's no formal information about that, but traditionally what's happened in the past couple of years is that very good. You know, it's been iOS and the iPhones in September, and then iPad and the OS X update in October. So there's a reasonable expectation, I think, that we'll see it in the next sort of 3 to 4 weeks. Certainly the updates for the betas have gone a little bit quiet, I think. I haven't seen a developer preview update for a while, so that tends to suggest that things are wrapping up.
One of the things that's interesting is the rumor I heard that the only iPad to getting a major update this year is the Pro, mm-hmm. the big one that's soon to be released, and that in the spring that the Air and the Retinas would see updates. And that's if that happens, that's very interesting how they address the Christmas season mm-hmm. versus the educational buying season. So that'll be interesting rumor to watch.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a very interesting time for the iPad over the next year or so. It's definitely feeling the pressure from these phones in the lower end of the size range, and then there is I feel there's certainly some pressure from, I'm not saying the sales pressure, but the Microsoft Surface Pro 3, I think the more people who are heavy iPad users look at that, the more they think, I really like that, apart from all the bits that Microsoft did in software. And I think I've had more than one conversation recently with, you know, iPad teachers who have said, yeah, see, if it's like that Surface Pro 3 but actually ran iOS, that would be super cool. So I think it's going to be an interesting time. I mean, I feel that the iPad mini is secure. And the reason I feel it's secure is just because of cost. I mean, people often compare the iPhone 6 Plus to an iPad mini, but I feel that if you look at the actual relative cost, I mean, the iPhone 6 Plus is what, you know, £600-700, and you can get an iPad mini for 250. You know, so I also think that iPad mini, the low-end model, has really taken over the role of the iPod Touch for many families and children. Having an iOS device in the house that the kids can use or whatever, I know it certainly fills that role in our house. I would never dream of buying my kids an iPod Touch anymore, but I have bought them iPad mini, and I see that over and over again with families in the school, is that the kids who are coming through now, who 5 years ago would have had an iPod Touch, now have an iPad mini.
Yeah, because music isn't the dominant factor for these devices any longer. If they wanted just a music player, the iPod Nano is really the best device. Yeah. But if they need just kind of a general purpose computing, games, things like that, the iPad mini is really the best device. And especially if they could somehow keep getting that price lower, maybe the original iPad mini stays around, we can eventually get it down to $199. Mm-hmm. I know we all want the A5X to die, but that would sell very well.
I think one of the people who are making a big mistake right now is Instagram. That they should have an iPad app, a native iPad app, and I can't believe they still don't. But for those younger kids and teenagers, I mean, I'm not saying that I completely approve of this, but certainly it is certainly true that the number one social network for kids, sort of 10 to 14, is Instagram. It's not Facebook, it's not Twitter, it's nothing like Twitter. Kids are not interested at all in Twitter, but they are all about Instagram. And that's it's very interesting to me, but it's also, I really think that Instagram should have an iPad app to sort of capitalize on that.
Totally agree, and I can tell you that's true, but the number of students they have to deny their following requests on Instagram.
Yeah.
No doubt. So, main topic for tonight is something we have never talked about, and it's not something that probably a lot of IT people really think about day to day or when they're doing their strategy. It's probably something that really only comes to them when it's demanded of them to deal with. It's cafeteria software and management.
Yeah.
You know, and how you deal with this is largely going to depend on the type of school you're at from the size. Mm-hmm. I mean, just like how you do tuition management at a 50-person school versus a 3,000-person school or a 20,000-person district, those details matter. And because the smaller you are, the more you can largely brute force solutions to save money or to be flexible. Yeah. Would you agree?
Oh, yeah, completely. And we are absolutely low-tech on this. I mean, none of what we do with cafeteria is computerized in any way whatsoever because, you know, the school's only 100 pupils and not all of them even take advantage of the cafeteria. Many children bring a packed lunch. So it's never been cost effective for us to even think about spending like my time basically to try and automate that process when it can perfectly easily be handled on paper. So this is really going to be your show, Bradley, because I don't have a huge amount more to say about that. But obviously I've been to other schools and I've seen other things in operation. So I'll chip in where I can.
So at Brainerd, we have about 300 students, depending on the day, I guess, or depending on how many kids are coming and going at, you know, throughout the year. And so we're kind of in that middle of the pack. Now, we've got three different options for lunch. I'm not sure how you guys do, but there's three different options at our school. You can do the annual plan, which is where you basically pay it up front, and it's $650, and that includes it's all you can eat all year long. And you can either pay for it one big check, or you can actually break it up over with your tuition. We charge tuition monthly. You can do you can either do like a half and half, or a 12 month. I think you can do a 9 month as well. So divide that up. We also can do what's called a lunch ticket, and that's where you pay $130, and that includes 30 meals. Now, that does last all school year. It's not necessarily 30 days. It's not like you have to use it in a month, but it's basically you're pre-buying 30 meals, and this is a physical ticket, and we only sell this by check and cash.
Okay.
And the reason is because our margins on cafeteria are very tight. Yeah. I don't. I'm sure y'all's is the same way, but it's largely a break even business. So if we can save a processing payment, we're going to do it.
No, definitely, yeah, and I think that's pretty much a universal experience of school food is that the margins are always tight.
Well, and if you think about it, you're basically running a restaurant, and the meals have to be. I'll explain the last one. You can get a cost per meal. But if you order online and you kind of do a la carte, it's $5 per meal. Mm-hmm. And if a student shows up and eats but doesn't have the lunch ticket or isn't on the annual plan and hasn't pre-purchased, we just charge them. And the everything is done through RenWeb. They have a cafeteria management system. And then we charges go there as well. And you can actually order for like tomorrow up until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning. That's when the cafeteria staff, you know, checks it for the last time. And so, you know, if you think about it, we're serving a meat and vegetables and milk for $5. Mm-hmm. And that's, if you look at how a restaurant operates, you don't see many restaurants that can charge $5 for all of that.
No, it's super tight.
Now, you know, it's one of those things where we are happy to lose $3,000 or less per year. We made a little money last year, but you know, we've had years where we lost more than that. And our neighboring county schools, they lose millions of dollars a year on their cafeteria.
Yeah. Is it a legal obligation for people to provide school meals? Is that
public school, it is. I don't guess legally have to, but it's one of those things, every school does it. Our focus, you know, operationally is on the annual plan.
Right.
And so, you know, our long-term goal is we would love to just be out of the per meal business, the lunch ticket business that is just included in the tuition. Mm-hmm. And because that allows you, the biggest thing with, you know, in terms of financing is number of students eating per day. The more that, you know, the less kids you have that are bringing their lunch, the better off kind of like, you know, your cost per meal goes down at that point because you have all those fixed costs from the staffing, from the infrastructure, from the electricity, all that. And so you need your cost per day to be good. Mm-hmm. So again, you've got annual plan, $650, lunch ticket, $130, and that works out to about $433 a meal, or a la carte online is $5. And so kind of how our process runs monthly, you know, kind of just how we communicate the menu. I get it from the cafeteria and we get it to the parents is usually the last week of the month, I receive a Word copy of the lunch menu. I immediately, like any good IT person, convert that to PDF because we do not post Word documents anywhere on our
because
website.
You're not a caveman.
I cannot stand that. When I see that, I just want to edit it, save it, and email it back to them.
Yep.
And so then, now the way RenWeb's menu system works is I actually have to go in there and build each meal and assign a cost to it. Now, it has a lot of things in there for free and reduced lunch that is obviously public school driven that we don't even touch. Mm-hmm. We just say it's $5 per meal. Now, the problem is, it's like what's awesome is like when the staff uses the same meal month to month because I don't have to rebuild that meal. It's like an arrow interface. I choose a day, I click a meal, and I arrow it over. Mm-hmm. Well, when they like say have the same meat but then change side dishes, I have to make an entire new meal, which is a pain, but I don't feel like I can complain about that.
Yep.
So I then load that in RenWeb. And I basically go into October. Like one of the things I did this week is last week I added in October's menu. I went in there and said parents can order up through October 31st, and that basically means it's loaded. I'll then send an email to our families, say here's the PDF copy of the menu, and explain to them how they can go in and order online. And now we've really struggled with this communication wise, where parents think even if they're on the annual plan, they have to go in and order.
Right.
And you know, we've explained that multiple times, and I don't know, maybe that's one of those things, those are the questions we're going to have, because they'll go in there and basically add meals essentially to their cart, but then they don't ever complete the order. And that really screws up the cafeteria staff and the software, because then they see unpaid meals in there, because they see a record of who's added that, but we don't consider it ordered until it's actually paid for.
Yeah.
So payments are handled by RenWeb's payment system, which is called PayNow. We just get deposits every few days with those. And the transaction fees are very minimal, but it is something. It's not nothing. I mean, it ends up being usually $30, $40 a month. But I think that's largely because we've done a good job about pushing people to the launch ticket, mm-hmm. And we can avoid those fees. Yeah. And that's kind of our monthly process on how we set up the month each month. How do you guys kind of communicate that to your families?
We mostly do it by a lot of our stuff is still in the kind of old fashioned sense of parents sending money in an envelope like they used to, and they still do that for some things. You know, the book club and the deposits for a trip and stuff, and lunch bills are part of that as well. I mean, there is from what you're saying, Bradley, I understand that, or I assume that there's no cash being transferred during lunchtime. Is that right?
It's correct. There is no POS system. There is no cash register there.
Okay.
Any payments that happen are, if a parent comes in and they've got $3, we'll take it. But the idea is everything to be digital. You know, they've either, they're on the lunch ticket, they're on the annual plan, and if they haven't ordered through RenWeb, we just charge the parents' RenWeb account $5. And at the end of... At the end of every week, on Sunday at 11 o'clock, there's like a database job that runs in RenWeb. Mm-hmm. Any parents with a balance above $1, they get an email with like, hey, you've got a lunch balance of $10. Here's how you pay.
Right.
So we try to limit, because things in our cafeteria are quite crazy, as I'm mm-hmm. sure most schools are. And so we're trying to limit the kind of the amount of confusion and transporting of money and who gave me this money and who needs to charge. And we're trying to eliminate that.
Yeah, yeah. We have a split lunchtime at our school, so the junior half of the school come in at 12 o'clock, and then the senior half come in at 40 minutes later. So we try and manage the complexity that way a little bit, and because of our numbers, it's not too difficult to do.
Well, and I think this goes to you have to understand your school's mm-hmm. type, and if you are a K-12 with 1,000 students, you know, how you may have to have more of an assembly line approach. Like there's a lady that probably sits at the cash register.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's one member of staff just doing money.
Before we finish up there, let's thank our next sponsor mm-hmm. of the night. It's the fine folks at Aerohive. They unleash the power of enterprise mobility. Their technology allows organizations of all sizes to use mobility to increase productivity, engage customers, and grow their businesses. Aerohive is deployed in over 13,000 enterprises worldwide. They have an incredible cloud-managed, controllerless Wi-Fi system, so there's no controller on site. If one AP goes down, the rest of the APs intelligently take over and they boost coverage. It's really the best Wi-Fi we've seen. Learn more about it at aerohive.com. That's AEROHIVE.com, and there'll be a link at the show notes at outofschool.net. So that's kind of our monthly process. The next thing we do, there's kind of like day-to-day stuff, like how do we do this process day-to-day? Yep. And there's a little bit of low-tech here just because of the, how it is, teachers' classrooms are busy. And then our cafeteria staff is not as technical savvy as, say, some of our teachers. And that's not a knock against them. That's just not what they're asked to do. Mm-hmm. And so every day... teachers will ask each student, like, okay, who's ordering what? And we have a hot lunch every day, and then we have a sandwich, soup, salad, and baked potato bar. So teachers essentially call in their order to the cafeteria. They say, okay, and this is Mrs. Jones's class. I've got 7 hot lunches, and I've got 5 sandwich, soup, salad, and baked potato bars. And then that's it. They're done. Now,
and is your hot lunch is one meal? Right.
Yes, so it's like steak fingers or pizza or hamburger. Yep. Yeah, so there's so like there's,
either
a, there's
that
the
or
hot
the sandwich bar. Yep.
Sandwich. Yeah, I really like the sandwich bar. I actually ate that today. I usually eat peanut butter and jelly sandwiches every day, and I was getting quite sick of that. Do you go out for lunch daily?
No, we actually have a pretty short lunch time in our school. We have 30, 40 minutes, depending on what stage of the school you're at. So it's kind of a quick turnaround for us because we have other constraints to do with the time of the end of the day and things like that. So we have a pretty intense, compact day in our school, so we don't get a very long lunch time. Some of our kids do go out for lunch, and they sort of rush all the way down to the shops and then rush all the way back, and they usually make it in time. I could never get there as quick as they can back, but the allure of Subway or whatever it is they like is strong.
You spend half your lunch break in the car just to shovel down your food in 5 minutes.
Now that you mentioned that, quiet lunch in my car might be quite appealing.
It's true. I go out maybe one day a week. I eat a lot of peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, really just because I'm cheap. And I'll go to the store, and I'll get sandwich stuff and chips, and I will literally eat on that for 2 weeks. So I'll spend $15 for 2 weeks. Mm. But today I was a little hungry, and I did not feel like eating another peanut butter and jelly sandwich. So I went downstairs and got a turkey sandwich and a bowl of soup. I got a bowl of chicken noodle soup. So not, and we pay $3 per meal as a faculty. I guess that's like our cost, is we figure $3 per meal. And so that's what they charge the faculty. I would love it if the faculty got to eat free. I know some of the schools near us that have were basically where the students have to eat there. Like mm-hmm. they're paid for it, whether they eat there or not. The faculty gets to eat for free. And that would be nice, like free lunch every day. It's like even show up on Saturdays, but it's like, can we eat here? Because a lot of those schools have boarders, so that actually their cafeteria is open. So I'm going to eat breakfast and dinner on the weekends. No. mentioned the lunch tickets. Mm-hmm. Again, this is something we actually print. We have, I think Vista prints it for us. And these are individually numbered tickets. And so these are, if you think about it, these things are worth $130. So the teachers do keep up with them. We don't ask, like, first graders to keep up with tickets that are worth $130. Mm-hmm. That would not go well.
The teacher looks after them.
Yeah, she does. And they're individually numbered, and we keep track of what number goes with what student in case one goes missing. Mm-hmm. And so when the classroom goes in there, again, we've got nothing digital in there at the time, but the lunchroom staff has a list of each class of who is on the annual plan, who has a lunch ticket, and then who is ordered online.
Mm-hmm.
So they have that printed off. So they come in there just marking off. Say, okay, Jim Smith, we have you here. You're an annual plan. Betty Sue, you have a lunch ticket. And Chris Thompson, your parents ordered online, so you're running web order. And again, anyone not on that list gets marked off, as a charge. So that actually will get sent to me. What we do, it's actually they used to actually bring me a handwritten sheet with all the charges, and I said, wait a minute. Bradley doesn't do handwritten sheets, so we have a Google spreadsheet that they go in there, just fill out the student name, what days they charged, and what they're actually owed. So if they ate 2 days, it says $10, and I will get that would then go post that on RenWeb, and we email out the parents, and we'll have parents that will build up a balance of a few $100 throughout the year, mm-hmm. but they can't get their last report card until it's paid for.
Okay, it's a good handle to leverage.
Yeah. Yeah, and we've got a nice mix of technology versus not, no technology. Now, the trend, I don't know about in Scotland, the trend in America is a lot of schools are getting out of the cafeteria business completely, and they're completely outsourcing.
Mm. I've visited several schools that are in that situation. I visited a school a few years ago, actually, in Savannah, Georgia, where they had completely outsourced their cafeteria. I mean, it's not uncommon, but the thing that sticks in my mind from that visit was that they were serving Starbucks coffee in the cafeteria with a massive sign over it that said, coffee is for staff only. And just imagine the havoc that would be wreaked if children started taking Starbucks at lunchtime.
Yeah, that'd be quite interesting. Yeah. We actually had something here recently where, we had our cafeteria gets actually inspected by the health department. Mm-hmm. And they kept putting the ice scoop back in the ice, and that's apparently like a health violation. Mm-hmm. And so they have gotten rid of the ice temporarily.
Huh.
As kind of like a punishment to people. It's like, all right, you're not going to follow the rules. We're getting rid of the ice temporarily. Yeah. Now we've investigated full blown POS systems, mm-hmm. and it really in RenWeb has something built in where you can print off cards and kids can scan. But again, these things are fantastic, but you've got to make sure that you don't overthink it. I guess and if you've got a school of 200 kids, you don't need to print out a tag individually and go through spending $10,000 to $20,000 on a system that you absolutely just don't need.
Yeah, no, I mean this is kind of the situation I'm in. Is I could storm in tomorrow and say, like, we're going to go electronic and here's how we're going to do it and blah 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 blah. But then, you know what's going to happen, right? Is that, there's something that's going to go wrong with them, and then I'm going to get pulled out of my class at lunchtime to go and fix the the cafeteria software, you know, whereas the piece of paper never breaks down and it never gets overloaded. You know, it's not, we simply don't need to go beyond that yet. So we'll wait and see if we ever do. I'd love to have that problem, right? You know, that's the kind of problem I'd love to have, but we don't have it right now.
Well, and that's a great point, because no technology is going to be perfect. And depending on how mission, you got to look at how mission critical something is versus what your available resources are at the time. Yeah. I mean, let's say you have a cache system and the cache drawer breaks. Do you know how to fix a cache drawer?
Mm-hmm. Nope.
I have no clue how to do that. So we're kind of we really looked at POS systems last year and we're investigating the cost. And there's a lot of solutions out there that do it. We kind of came down to the fact that A, it didn't integrate in with RenWeb. Mm-hmm. RenWeb's solution was okay, and what we had now isn't totally terrible. I mean, it's somewhat, it's yeah. working. It's not the most efficient, but it's very inexpensive, and we can work.
I mean, are there parents asking you for a point of sale system? Are there parents wanting to pay cash on the day?
No, it's really teachers that were pushing it because they were tired of dealing with the lunch tickets.
Right.
And where they were wanting a system like where we could actually preload a barcode scan that the kids could just scan through as they walk by, and it would be preloaded with money.
Mm-hmm. So then you don't have to keep a track of who got what.
Exactly, because the teachers, the idea is when the tickets get down to like 5 tickets left, they're supposed to email the parents and say, "Hey, your lunch ticket's getting low. You need to kind of reorder them." Mm-hmm. Of course, then parents say, "Oh, it's great. Can I buy it online anywhere?" And then it's like, "No, sorry, you can't."
Yeah. So it's not a completely sealed system just yet. You know, there are some parts that are still analog and some parts that are not.
Yeah, and I'm okay with that for now. I mean, again, mm-hmm. if I was at a school with 1,200 kids, you would have to figure out a way to automate every part of that, and you'd probably have to have less options. It would probably be you're either going to pay a la carte meal, or you're going to pay for the unlimited plan. You're going to build it into your tool.
Yeah, so I mean, that's a good number of things to think about. I mean, I don't know what you feel, Bradley, but this always feels like this is probably the one thing that's right next to printer accounting that no sysadmin really gets into the job to get excited about, is dealing with lunch money and dealing with printing queues and print accounting. But these are the things that kind of grease the wheels of a school, don't you think?
Well, and these are the things that they're largely the experiences that your parents see. I mean, they don't care about how great your Wi-Fi works, but if your lunch system seems convoluted and janky, yep. then they think, well, what else? I mean, these guys can't seem to get it together operationally, so how could they do anything else that they're willing to, you know, to promote?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a strong point, because in some ways you're sort of, we've talked about this before in the show, that, you know, part of our job is designing user experiences for people, you know, whether that be for teachers or for students or for parents. And this is one of these aspects. It's kind of like the homework diary. It's one of the few things that is seen at home that you do in school as well. And I think you're right that it's important to make those as professional as you can make them without, you know, killing yourself in terms of effort and cost and so on. I mean, I feel like one of the similar things that we've done recently is we switched from using Google Groups for sending emails to parents. We switched to using MailChimp. And I think what that's done for us is it's given our emails a much more professional appearance to parents. And I think the response rates have been... it's been useful for us because we can then track the response rates as well. But I think also parents are engaging more with the newsletters and the emails and stuff that we send, because they do look a little more professional than they ever did before.
Now, are you able to share what your open rate is on the newsletters you send homeschool wide?
It's pretty variable, to be honest with you. I think it very much depends on the kind of message that we're sending. Sometimes if it's just a, hey, there's an event happening, those open rates can be low. You know, they can be 50 to 55%. And I mean, that's great compared to what most people see on their lists. But I think the assumption always with schools is that parents and families just read every single thing we send, and all they're doing is waiting for us to send them something, and then they're going to read it avidly. The amount of effort they put into reading it compared to the amount of effort we put into make it is vastly disproportionate. But in fact, the more important the email, the better rates we get. But actually, the biggest ones are Christmas plays and trips. those are the ones that get 90%+ open rates, because I think that, you know, it's funny, you know, we do all this effort for curriculum and IT and, you know, planning and tracking and monitoring, and the thing everybody loves is a Christmas play, you know. At the end of the day, you know, school's a bit more than just your grades, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, we have largely started to realize that we have to communicate with our parents like a business does ads, and realize mm-hmm. just saying something one time, people aren't going to hear it. And we're having to say it 3 to 4 times before an average amount of people read it. And yeah. I realized, like, I used to complain, like, they should read it. We're taking the time to build these newsletters that we mm-hmm. send home. They should read them. But now that I'm a parent, I don't read them.
This is true. I mean, the other thing we do in school is the school blogs, and that's been a very popular thing, that each class has a blog, and teachers will write on those blogs. To be honest with you, the primary teachers are better at it at the moment, because they sort of have their own blog, whereas the secondary teachers have got like one for junior secondary and senior secondary. And you know what it's like when you give 4 people 100% of the responsibility, each of them take 5%. So the secondary teachers are, maybe I'm just actually talking about myself here, are not as committed to blogging regularly as the primary teachers are. But that's a major way that we communicate home to school, particularly for things that are changing in the week. If there's something special happening, what we know is that it's actually the number one way that our primary teachers communicate with their parents is by posting it on their blog. And it's very interesting to me that that has gained such acceptance in that part of the school, as the primary method of homeschool communication is through blogging it rather than through sending emails or doing anything like that. In secondary, we tend to send more emails because we're sending to multiple year groups at once about certain things. And I'm certainly more into using MailChimp to communicate with parents than necessarily writing it on the blog, because I guess I don't believe that normal people read blogs, but I think the primary teachers have done such a great job at building up so much engagement on their blogs that they can actually be very confident that whatever they put on the blog, the vast majority of their parents will see and act upon, which is a real testament to the amount of effort they've put into that over the years.
Yeah, because I always feel like unless someone is subscribed to something via RSS, or you're posting that notification somewhere else where they're checking whether, like, it's like if I post a link to my blog on Twitter, you have a chance to see that there. Mm-hmm. But like people just actually like randomly going to a teacher's blog, that's incredible that they're doing that regularly.
Yeah. Yep. And I actually ran into a problem. I think that I actually have a real gap in my understanding of how those parents use the internet, because when we changed the composition of the classes this year, so some of your groups moved up and some were recombined, I made new blog pages for all the new classes. And what I did was I password protected the old ones. And then we got a whole bunch of phone calls saying, hey, the blog is asking me for a password. What's wrong with the blog? And I realized that what they were doing was they were using a bookmark. And I was like, who uses a bookmark anymore, you know? But that's completely, you know, self-obsessed, because that's how I use the web, is I subscribe to things through RSS, or I just type in the URL and go to the page I want, whereas these people had used a bookmark. And it's like, well, why wouldn't they use a bookmark, right? But it seems like such a kind of old-fashioned thing compared to what the way I use those kind of technologies as well, so... in the end, we sent out an email saying, if you have an old bookmark, please delete it and just go to the new page and bookmark the new page. And then that solved the problem. But I just didn't anticipate that that was going to be an issue for those parents.
And one of the ways that our teachers have started to communicate with our parents, which I don't know that I like or would want if I was a teacher, is via iMessage. Mm-hmm. And that's something I think, you know, we'll probably delve into in a few weeks, and we'll talk about some of these things more in depth. But, you know, I've had, you know, I work in early room for the kids that come in early, mm-hmm. and the many times the teacher said, oh, I forgot to tell your teacher about that, I'll just send her a text message.
Yeah.
And that concept to me, I don't know that I like, because I don't know that I would want the ability for a parent to be able to text me at any given point.
Yeah, I have been discouraging that in our school. I certainly don't do it myself, and most teachers don't, but one or two do. And I've been discouraging it because I feel like from a data protection point of view, that I would feel better if that kind of information was communicated through our email system, so that, you know, it was part of a managed service that we sort of controlled and we knew who was accessing it and so on. I mean, I don't have concerns about the security of iMessage, for example, but it's just like putting that kind of information through personal accounts is not something that I would in fact instruct our teachers never to send out information about pupils through iMessage. But in the circumstance you're talking about, and this is how it happens for us mostly as well, is that the parent will actually initiate the communication over some alternative channel like iMessage or SMS. And in that case, the parent has made the decision to use that channel for communication. So it's kind of like an implicit permission, if you like. But I personally would prefer that stuff was emailed to teachers rather than... I don't know if, again, I'm just being old-fashioned about it or just being paranoid about it, but I would... It's not just the sort of 24/7 accessibility thing, but I just feel like I would rather have that in our email system, if you know what I mean.
Well, and our policy is that we respond to all parent communication within 24 hours. Mm-hmm. And we have no way to track that via iMessage. And I feel like that, you know, I'm kind of thinking about it from the 24/7 access. And like, if I send you an email, like there's no kind of, I don't expect you to respond as the second you read that.
Yeah.
But if I send you an iMessage, like that's, I guess, the protocol is that you will respond immediately. Mm-hmm. And if it's Friday night or if it's Tuesday night and the teacher's, it's 9 o'clock and you're texting about homework,
yeah,
they almost feel like I need to respond because then they won't have their homework done. Well, no, you know, like when you and I were in school, if you didn't know, you asked a friend. You didn't call the teacher at home.
Yeah. I mean, if it comes to a bit, post something in iTunes U is what I say to kids, because we obviously now we have the iTunes U discussion feature. But yeah, it's one of these things, and we had that actually early in the iPad deployment where pupils had email sort of 24/7 for the first time. And what we would see is that like 11 o'clock the night before, teachers were getting emails from kids saying, Mr. Spears, I don't understand the homework. Thanks very much. Blah. I was like, well, you know, just because you... And it was quite transparently a sort of last-minute thing. I've either run out of time or I forgot to do it, and I'll just send an email the day before saying I didn't understand it. Therefore, that means it's okay for me not to do my homework. And we have really come down very hard on that and said, look, if you don't understand your homework, you have usually days to do your homework. It's quite rare, at least in secondary, that we'll set homework for the next day. So you have to look at it as soon as you get it, make sure you understand it, and then you're not allowed to email your teacher and say you didn't understand it at 11 o'clock the night before it's due. And that's just something that we've had to deal with through policy as much as anything else.
Before we wrap up, let's thank our last sponsor of the night, the fine folks at Tap Typing. Tap Typing is an app that teaches students to type on the iPad. It's got a structured curriculum with lessons ranging from beginning to advanced, a typing test for gauging improvement, and in addition to the built-in keyboard, it has support for all types of external keyboards and cases. Now, Tap Typing is appropriate for students of all ages and supports multiple user profiles, which is extremely handy for CartBlate. Tap Typing is appropriate for all ages and supports multiple user profiles, which is extremely handy for CART-based classroom environments. After just 3 sessions in Tap Typing, beginners increase their typing speeds by over 60% on average. This minimal time investment yields a permanent boost to productivity and soothes one of the most painful aspects of the iPad user experience, typing. I own 81 copies of this app. I've said that for weeks. We use it throughout the year. It is the app for typing on the iPad. If you want to learn more, go to gettaptyping.com. Or just search for typing on the App Store. Now, one of the things that's cool, I haven't mentioned this, and we weren't even told to say this, but Tap Typing has done what I wish more developers would do. They have 2 versions of their app. They have a free one with a bunch of in-app purchases. When I say a bunch, I mean like 4. But then they have a paid one that schools can buy. Mm-hmm. And that is how you do it. Because if Tap Typing was free with in-app purchase, schools could not deploy it. But because they have kind of a separate edition with no in-app purchase, and actually, you know, you actually pay for it, then, you know, we can go through the VPP process and get it, you know, licensed to all of our devices. So mm-hmm. That very, very thankful that they do that. Yeah. So again, gettaptyping.com. You know, one of the things that, you know, as we kind of finish up here, we I didn't mention this when iOS 8 was released, and I've harped on RenWeb a lot throughout the years. I did a whole episode on it, Hypercritical and SIS. And I met with RenWeb extensively this summer at their conference when I went through all my complaints, and then they showed me their roadmap, and I was thinking, thumbs up, okay, I'm feeling better about you guys, because they talked about how their goal was to be cross-platform everywhere, and they were changing a lot of their back-end technology to allow themselves to kind of move faster towards new products. Again, we have to have Chromebook compatibility. That's like one of their main goals. That's like, okay, I'm feeling good. Well, then iOS 8's released, and they send an email out to every school. Do not tell your families not to upgrade to iOS 8. Our apps are broken.
Oh my goodness.
So I sent a message on Twitter, and to me, that is unacceptable for any app to be broken day one.
Well, certainly not to notify you like the day it ships, right? How far in advance did you have notification of that?
The day of.
See, that is not okay, right? If you know you're not going to make it, at least you've got it. I mean, you got to tell people well in advance that, hey, we're not going to make whatever deadline is, you know. To me, that smacks of not paying enough attention to Apple.
Well, and I asked them on Twitter. I said, guys, it's not feasible for me to tell every one of our families to hang off upgrading to iOS 8 because one app doesn't work. So were you not testing? And they responded with, it was working fine in the simulator, but there was a bug in the final version. Did you catch what I said? Simulator. So what they were doing was testing it in Xcode on the Mac. And they were not actually testing it on a device running iOS 8 because the GM was out, 2 weeks before the final release? Mm-hmm. That was the final release. They, at minimum, would have known 2 weeks before.
Yep.
And I want to punch a wall. And I think they've shipped updates now. But, that kind of stuff, when the iPad is a huge device in schools, and it's a huge device for parents, and you're not even running betas that cost $100 a year. You need one at 100. I guess they have they've got to have a developer account because they have apps. So they have a developer account. Mm-hmm. So they just didn't put it on a device. Like, can we not send them an iPad to use for next time?
Yeah,
I will send them one.
Seriously.
So that's my rant, but that's my big frustration with when you have these things that are not just apps, but they're services. Yep. That they're not keeping up with kind of the devices you're using.
Yeah, no, and it's interesting to me just the extent to which the world has changed fairly quickly. You know, I think let's be fair, it's not the case that every school is now an iPad school. That's not true. But the assumption that many of these platforms made that schools ran Microsoft Windows, end of story, is now completely broken. And if things are still running on that assumption, then that software is fundamentally not fit for purpose anymore. Now, yes, people are still using Windows, there's no doubt about it. People are still using OS X. But like you said, I mean, Chromebook compatibility is now a make or break feature for educational software. Now, how long has that been true? That's a new requirement in the past, I would say, probably 18 months that you and I have really been tracking Chromebooks. I think we've been out ahead of a number of places on thinking about that. Certainly people have deployed it where we haven't, but we've acknowledged that this is a phenomenon that people are going to have to take care of, and that's a new thing as well. And of course iOS mobile compatibility in all its real senses is a huge new requirement, and I think it's challenging, but it's not like you're getting the software for free, am I right?
Exactly. I mean, it's no longer acceptable to say we only work on Windows. I mean, we're seeing Adobe announce today a version of Photoshop for the Chromebook.
That's interesting.
And they've not pulled it off, and I've not used it. Mm-hmm. But if that works well, that is huge, because they say it will be a streaming app. I don't know what that means, but it's the full version of Photoshop. And that could be potentially huge for Chrome OS.
Yes, yes. And if the technology, whatever that is that has been built with, if that becomes something that's broadly available, I don't know if that's using just Chrome native client software, or in fact if it is some kind of HTML-based version of Photoshop, that's going to certainly be something that will be interesting to see if A, Chromebooks have enough power to actually run that effectively, B, if the bandwidth constraints aren't difficult, depending on what streaming app actually means, if you're not actually uploading large files to the cloud and then working with them on the cloud, it'll be interesting to see how that develops and what the pricing model and the deployment model is for that as well, because I bet that's not free. And I think it's my experience has been that most Chrome OS apps that I've used so far have essentially been free apps. And it'll be interesting to see what the paying model is for more of that stuff as time goes by.
I think it requires a Creative Cloud subscription.
Right.
But the cool thing is it has native support for Google Drive. So it saves the files right into Google Drive. And it's like you're seeing that, that's like, you say, okay, that's a pretty powerful software if it works, and it works with Google Drive. Mm-hmm. There's some neat workflows that you could create from that.
Oh, yeah.
But I have to go to faculty meeting, so I know most of our listeners will love to hear that. We have a faculty meeting in 8 minutes, so I have to go
Like to just say that I ran a meeting today in school, and I got a round of applause for A, declaring that I would finish it at 4 o'clock and finishing it at 3:59.
We've had one that was 12 minutes before. Our headmaster we do not have a lot of meetings, so we have one every other week. And it's usually 30 minutes, but he's gotten out of 12 minutes before. So I won't complain too bad, but got to have a meeting sometimes.
They got to happen.
So thanks to our sponsors this week, FindFox at Jamp Software, Tap Typing, and Arrowhive. We'll have all the show notes, all the links we mentioned, and links to all the sponsors. We would appreciate you supporting them at outofschool.net. And if you have a product or service that you want to promote to our listeners, they are the best looking listeners around, I've been told.
Yep.
And they also smell the best.
Mm-hmm.
Get in touch at outofschool.net. Yes. Get in touch at outofschool.net. There's a sponsorship tab, and you can get in contact. We would love to talk to you.
Okay. Talk to you later, Bradley.
Have a good week.